cosmic microwave background when you get the finer and finer details leads me to believe that there are certain directions where the rate of expansion is not the same. The stuff that's being sucked out of our universe because of the clumpiness of what's beyond that we can't see. We're starting to slowly see evidence of that as I see it, Luke. I wonder if any of that is surprising to you. Ed Trujillo, the science teacher of Brooklyn Tech. At least I think you were a science teacher, isn't that true, Luke? K2RIW, the tech man.
Well, first of all, you're confusing me with Rich, then to RQ here. And, a lot of this is only peripherally known to me. At professional meetings that I've attended at the joint meetings of the Chemistry Teachers Club of New York and the Physics Club of New York, we've had some rather interesting presentations. And incidentally, if anyone's interested, our next meeting is next Friday evening at NYU. I forgot the exact title, but it's about food chemistry, it should be rather interesting. The presentations, Alice is getting me my newsletter. It is a soupçon of science, culinary pedagogy. Professor Kent Kirschenbaum, Department of Chemistry and Director of Graduate Studies at NYU, and Desan Davis, chemistry teacher at Hunter College High School. If anyone's interested, as I said, they're welcome at the main building, the Silver Center, room 207, at 7:15. Since I just had that handy, this is N2RQ.
Yeah, sorry, I got the call letters mixed up, Lou, N2RQ. Now, one of the most interesting experiments that has been done throughout the history of radio astronomy is to recognize that, and this is how I think it relates to your chemistry societies and meetings, that each chemical element, carbon dioxide, oxygen, water, and so on, each chemical element, some of these are organic or non-organic, but they're basic building blocks of life, have very specific frequencies at which they emit a radio astronomy narrowband frequency signal, depending on their physical temperature. So the radio astronomers looking into space have seen a large list of chemicals floating around in space, so to speak. Hydrogen, I think, was one of the first ones measured. Roughly 1420 megahertz is the resonant frequency of a hydrogen molecule, an H, not an H2, an H1, if you know what I mean. So an H2 has another frequency, and oxygen has a whole bunch of frequencies around 60 gigahertz. So we have seen the basic building blocks of life floating around in space by radio astronomy-like chemistry measurements. So I wonder, in these chemical conferences, meetings that you're describing, Lou, have they occasionally touched on cosmology as a method of confirming that the chemistry has been out there for zillions of years, and we're slowly discovering it, and so that the raw ingredients of life, let me drop it, the raw ingredients of life are not unique to the Earth, they're everywhere. Wait long enough, the stuff is going to be dropping onto the Earth, so to speak, and you wait long enough and life will form. And the great measurement that was done by, I can't think of his name now, 1956, you know the one I'm talking about, John, where this guy was pouring inert materials into a flask and passing a spark through it, doing it for a couple of weeks. He came up with 13 of the amino acids of the 23 or 24. The basic building blocks were there in that flask. If you just take inert measurements and pass the spark through it. I can't think of his name. His advisor was Urey. It's called the Urey blank measurement, if you happen to remember his name. Over to you, John.
No, I can't recall it, Dick, but I know who you're speaking about, and also they have reissued that experiment and found more elements. He found quite a few, but there are more have been added, as I remember. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, he was smart enough to store in test tubes the materials that came out of that flask when he did that experiment. and they went to his desk drawer, withdrew those test tubes, and with more modern test equipment with greater sensitivity, they found more of the amino acids that were present in his original experiment. I can't think of his name. But as I said, Harold Urey was his advisor, and Harold Urey was nice enough to ensure that this guy got his name first on the article, because he did most of the work, even though at first he was, when he proposed this experiment, they were told that the chances of you finding what you're looking for are very slim, but he decided to do it anyhow. And so, beautiful experiment. So, life as we know it appears to be spontaneous. Wait long enough, you put the right raw ingredients together, life will happen every time. And the strong implication was that life would crawl out of that flask if you waited long enough. And the spark he was passing through it was merely simulating lightning. So you can take thoroughly inert materials, inorganic materials per se, well, I guess some of them are organic because they've got some carbon in them, and life will form if you wait long enough. It's another subset, let me drop it, of a scientific principle that if you start off with a large enough amount of raw materials, and if you allow them to interact for a long enough period of time, every reaction that is not forbidden, compulsory. You could say life is one of those compulsory results that comes from starting off with a large enough chunk of material, like planet Earth. There's a lot of stuff there. I think it's 10 to the 27 kilograms. A lot of stuff. A lot of various chemicals. And we're only 4.5 billion years. And when you look at the total history of life on planet Earth, and the way it was explained, that if you made a scale from, you hold your arms out sideways, one to the right and one to the left, and you start off with the left-hand pinkies, left-hand tips of your fingers, off to the right-hand tips of your fingers, and that's the whole chunk of time. And so we've had microbial life during most of that time. It's only the last couple of knuckles of your right hand that represents the amount of time where higher life forms, like invertebrate and vertebrate animals, came along, including mankind. Where Johnny come lately, the majority of the life of this planet was microbial and single-cell animals. So we think we've been here forever. And for people who think that we've seen dinosaurs, not a chance. Oh, you for any further comments on this, Lou? N2RQ, finally got his call letters right. K2RIW and TechNet. You brought up an interesting subject tonight, Lou.
Comment.
Okay, Leslie, I think, recognized. I'm glad I brought it. I knew this was the source that I wanted to come to because it was way beyond me. And there are so many facets that can be done beyond this in discussion. And but it's way beyond the range of one night. Thanks again, Dick. This is N2RQ.
I'm trying to get that name right now by looking it up.
Tuio, Dick.
Didn't it start with an M, Dick?
Yeah, Miller. Miller Urey Experiment, it's called. Why can't I think of Mr. Miller's first name? But Miller Urey did this experiment way back in roughly 1957 or so. Or it started, it says 1952. And the Don website won't give me Mr. Miller's first name. I know it very well. Thank goodness I'm not getting forgetful. Thank goodness I'm not getting old. I'll find it. But you look up Miller Urey, Urey Miller.
I'll find it in one of Carl Sagan's books. He was a student there at the time.
Yeah, I think he was a student at the University of Illinois when he did this. One of my transmitters is giving me a little bit of grief. It's overheated and decided to stop transmitting. So I'm on a back transmitter. Wes, I think you wanted to make a comment. N2XJN, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, N2XJN. But the most close to us evidence of bang that would be pretty quickly. Actually, it's not pretty quickly. The previous sign to it was cosmic spectrum radiation or microwave spectrum. that's the strongest evidence that Faraday has big band model. So he as a detective were playing a lot with that and supporting of this CR, the cosmic record regime. That is being used in the
project that was Stanley Miller
to support the theory, which actually stands about the afterglow of the Big Bang, called to find whisper microwave spectrum by expansion of the universe. And the age of it, sure, I believe 15 billion years, something like that. Now, the problem with uniformity, let me jump. This isotopic nature of the cosmic background radiation. The first is that when we look at the microwave background coming from those widely spread parts of the sky, it can be shown that those regions are too separated to have been able to communicate with each other. And even with the signals traveling at light velocity, it's kind of weird. So, we might think about exactly the same temperature, or the general problem that is called the horizon problem. The second one was the homogeneity and isotropics. So that was the present universe is homogeneous and isotropic. But which scale we apply to that? On the very large scale would be possible, but for scales the size of superclusters and smaller, the luminous matter in the universe is quite lumpy. And what I could say about it is, so far I didn't see the evidence of the directionalism of that cosmic radiation to be pointing at multi-Big Bang event. I wonder what you say about it. It's interesting.
There are articles written by people who think they're seeing evidence of clumpiness and variations in the rate of expansion. It's also kind of amazing that only a few percent of the observable universe is the stuff that we can see by way of dark energy and dark matter. A hell of a lot of the universe is not visible to us. But the main question I've got for you, Lou, is your chemical society meetings. I wonder if they've ever mentioned the chemistry that has been observed in free space by radio astronomy means, various chemicals that have already been observed. N2RQ, K2RIW, go ahead, Lou.
Yeah, I must admit that I can't recall. We've had quite a number of astronomy programs, but I can't recall specifically that topic. I'll ask some of the other members. Maybe somebody remembers. And if not, maybe we'll find a speaker for it.
WS2N, Dick, I just want to give you a quick space report. I know it's getting late.
Boy, am I forgetful, Paul. WS2N with the space report. Number 192. Go right ahead, Paul. How the hell I forgot you. You got it. K2RIW, you sound good tonight, Paul.
Dick, by the way, your signal got very noisy.
I know that, John. I'm using a backup transmitter while I'm waiting for my main transmitter to cool off. When it overheats, it decides to stop transmitting. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Very good. And by the way, John said that, I don't know if you heard him before, he said the guy's first name was Stanley, Stanley Miller. So, Dick, I just wanted to go over really five different launches that are coming up within the next 3 weeks. And we actually have one going up in a couple of hours called the Trace Gas Orbiter.
it's being launched by the European Space Agency, so NASA has nothing to do with it. They did it one time, but they, you know, money dried up and they backed out. So they're launching a spacecraft that's going to go to Mars, and roughly around 5 o'clock this morning, you know, coming up 5:30 in the morning, they're going to launch from Kazakhstan, Baikonur. They made a deal with the Russians to launch these series of rockets to Mars. So the Proton rocket is going to be utilized, not the Soyuz, but the Proton, which is a heavy vehicle. And they plan on sending this 4.5-ton contraption to Mars, and should get there probably in October. Now, along with this Trace gas orbiter, that'll be like the mothership that'll go into orbit and look for methane, which of course is the idea is to look for methane and possible sign of life on board the spacecraft. Or Trace is another spacecraft which is going to separate from it, and it's called Schiaparelli, and it's going to be a lander. European Space Agency wants to be able to demonstrate that they can land successfully on that planet. They haven't done it yet. They tried it once quite a few years ago with a little robotic lander called Beagle 2, but it didn't work out. They never got a signal back from it, so that apparently it crashed. In fact, they found the remains of it, you know, 10 years later, using the high-rise camera on board the Mars Global Surveyor. So let me drop it. This is part of their whole ExoMars project. That's what they're calling this. Is once this is accomplished, the next window opens up 2 years from now. Every 2 years, roughly, you have another window opening up for Mars, and at that time they'll be ready with the rover. They're sending a rover there again on a Proton rocket launched by Roscosmos. They're the ones that handle this stuff, and it'll be launched from Kazakhstan again, and that'll be a solar powered rover. Yeah, we'll see how it goes. That, you know, they plan on having a drill on board to drill 2 meters into the ground, which is pretty good considering all we've gotten down is maybe, you know, 5 or 6 centimeters so far. The thing, they plan on going down 2 meters. That's the main launch coming up right away tomorrow morning. And then within the next 3 weeks, there's you know, a total of 5 launches, so quite a bit. Actually, there's a couple more, but I consider these to be the main ones. The Soyuz manned spacecraft will be launched on the 18th, so right after St. Patrick's Day. And you have three on board. Jeff Williams will be the American representative on that flight. And he's going up with two cosmonauts to the International Space Station, and they'll join the other three on board. Now, Williams is a ham, so that'll be good for the amateur radio on the International Space Station group. He'll make contacts with people, and then you have right now on board. You have three. The three that are on board are a Russian. Actually, you had you've got an American, Tim Kolber, another Tim, I forget his name, Tim Peake, I think, he's from European Space Agency, and a Russian, and they're all hams, so I know you have at least 5, the other 2 guys might be hams as well. So, you've got those 2 missions, and then you've got one following that. A couple of days later, on March 22nd, you have a Cygnus spacecraft loaded with equipment, food, and God knows what else. You know, it's another cargo mission being launched from Florida by Orbital ATK.
the builder of the Cygnus spacecraft. They're the ones that will eventually have their Antares back on track, and that'll be going up in May. But they're the ones that had the problem launching from Wallops Island, which had blown up the Cygnus spacecraft. Listing is ready to fly on Atlas V. They've done this one other time. They kind of like rented a space on the Atlas V, and that's always put up by Boeing and Lockheed, by the United Launch Alliance. That's part of the Boeing Lockheed group. We launched on the 22nd, and followed by two more cargo missions on the 31st. You have a Progress mission going up, and that's a Russian cargo vehicle, and that'll be docked to the Russian side of the base station. And also followed a couple of days later on April 4th. It was supposed to go up on the 31st. It delayed a couple of days. But April 4th, you have a Dragon vehicle going up, not only with cargo. SpaceX is sending up the Beam Habitat module. That's the one that's going to be attached to the Tranquility node, one of the modules on the International Space Station. After it's attached, the crew will pressurize it, and it will expand about two or three times its diameter. It'll open up to roughly a small room, only about 10 by 13, but it's a proof of concept. I'll leave it attached for about 2 years to see how it does. Check for leaks, radiation penetration, and all of that. They're ones I wanted to mention. There's other things, but I just want to get in those five flights, one right after the other, all jammed together in the next 3 weeks. Dick, over to you, K2LIW, this WS2N space report, 192 actually.
Space report number 192, successfully transmitted. Let's find out if we've got any people with any further questions on what Paul has just given us. Give me your call letters right now, K2LIW listening.
N2RQ.
And by the way, Lou, because of your usual way you present yourself to the college, to the school, to Brooklyn Tech, I should have been calling you Mr. Malchick, or Professor Malchick, but Mr. Malchick instead of Lou. Do your students know you as Lou, or they know you as Mr. Malchick? N2RQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, it varies. Mostly Mr. Malchick, but when it comes to email and other stuff, I'm much less formal, especially when we take them on the air. I was interested in one thing that I didn't hear Paul mention, and that is the micro satellite, the CubeSat, STM SAT-1 that we're waiting for deployment. Do you have any update on that? One that we're looking to receive pictures from, 3-watt transmitter that we're able to copy. Back to you, and to our team.
Yeah, Don, good question. Go ahead, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the tech man.
I did see that one. I was trying to figure out how to keep it oriented, pictures. So I haven't gotten enough information on that. I'm trying to get information on a whole bunch of CubeSats. It was an interest in it, of course, last week. But trying to find out information such as, when it first started, how many were there. I think the hams were the first ones that started with these things. I remember reading quite a few years ago QST pictures of it. I think we were like groundbreaking with CubeSats, and now other people have jumped on the bandwagon. So I don't have any information regarding that, but I did see the one with the I was going to take pictures, transmit it back down. Dick, back to you.
Paul, let me ask you this question. The CubeSat are going to be launched from where? I can see they might be launched from the International Space Station, or they might be part of the cargo of other launch craft that are going to release them. Are all the CubeSats from one launch location or the other, or are they kind of scattered? WS2N, K2LAW.
Years ago they started, now they actually launched a couple from the space, from the shuttle, but most of them are now going to be done from the space station. But some of them, for instance, SpaceX went up about a year and a half ago, and one of the releases of CubeSats actually came from the second stage, you know, separated from the cargo vehicle, and this CubeSat is still attached to the second stage, and then they separated. So it's a variety of releases. On the first space launch system that they have coming up in 2018, they're going to send a they're going to test that thing out with an Orion spacecraft without people and send it to the moon to assist lunar orbit. And NASA's already got the people picked out that are going to have CubeSats on board and going to do some pretty good scientific investigations, not only of the moon, but of the sun. And they'll send information back. So CubeSats going to be on that. Soon we'll probably see them also attached to Mars landers, you know, before the craft actually lands, or send these things into orbit. So it's really coming around. Things shrunk down, and you do all this stuff now. Back to you, Dick.
I have the impression that some of the CubeSats either have or will be launched from the International Space Station. Now, to launch a CubeSat from the International Space Station, you don't just open up the window and push it out. You'd lose all the air pressure inside the International Space Station if you did that. And I don't think they put it into an airlock and just open up the outer door. I am guessing that a CubeSat that's going to be launched from the International Space Station is a combined effort with another spacewalk that's done for repair procedures or installation procedures. So I'm going to guess that the CubeSat is clipped onto his belt of an astronaut that's about to do a spacewalk to do a repair or an improvement, and then somewhere during that walk he releases the CubeSat. But then how does he do that? Just push it off in some direction, hope that it'll never come back and impact the International Space Station? What if you happen to know how to do that, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, they do it at an average of three times a year, and they saw it a few years back, I think, about a year or two ago, only a year or two ago. You have all these modules, maybe 10 or 12 modules up there, and some are by the Russians, and some are by us. We have the Discovery module, we have all the nodes, the big modules that connect all the other modules, and then European Space Agency has their module called the Columbus module, and then the Japanese one has the Kaibo module. It's actually one big one and one small one attached to it. Well, attached to this, you know, inside this Japanese Kaibo module, sometimes they pronounce it Kibo, it's K-I-B-O. By the way, that's the largest one of the modules that are up there. It's about 30 feet long. The astronauts have an airlock, just like what you said, and they'll put, you know, these CubeSats in there and push it in and then close the airlock behind it. It's a small airlock. You can't put a person through it. Let me drop it. And then they launch it from that. They have robotic arms. Japanese has a we don't use the Canadian robot, the big robotic arm that we use for everything else, like grabbing spaceships and stuff. We don't use that. We use the outside of the Kaibo module. They call it the patio. It's a big platform, and it's probably about 30 by 40 foot platform, and they have all these scientific experiments on it. But, well, attached to that, they have the Japanese robotic arm, so that in turn grabs. they plan on building another one of these airlocks and attaching it to an existing port on the space station. It'll be attached on the Tranquility module, the same module that the beam is attached to and the cupola is attached to. There's one extra port, and they want to attach this extra bigger diameter airlock system that could be used, you know, maybe half a dozen, like 10 times a year, a lot more times a year than the present 3 times a year that the Kaibo is used. And not only for sending out satellites, but maybe for bringing something large in. Big battery pack that needs to be worked on, or NASA wants to put a whole pump assembly, ammonia pump assembly. You know, they fit it right through the airlock and have the astronauts work on it right in there instead of replacing a whole big pump assembly. You know, you might be able to just change a valve or a fitting if something is broke or leaking. So it's going to serve multiple purposes, and the cost will come out of this private company because they plan on making money from launching all these CubeSat. They have schools and people, organizations lined up that are presently making these CubeSats, not only in our country, but all over the world. Back to you. This is WS2N.
So apparently there is a small arm on this airlock that launches the CubeSats. I guess I'm a little bit amazed that it's done that way, as opposed to attaching each CubeSat to a small spring assembly, and you release the spring by remote control of a solenoid, and that sends it off into some particular direction. The arm can lift it out of the airlock and then let go of it, but rarely do you use an arm to throw something. A human arm can throw a baseball, but I've never seen anybody use a mechanical arm to throw something. And you'd like to launch the CubeSat in a particular direction, away from the International Space Station, in order to make sure it doesn't come back and impact you. So to be launched by an arm and not a spring is kind of amazing to me. When they do launch CubeSats, they launch more than one at a time. And so this airlock that launches the CubeSats, is it used for launching other things, maybe getting rid of certain kinds of waste products? What else is that airlock used for if it's too small for a human being? Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Besides the Kaibo Japanese module, they have this big patio. I want to call it a patio. Well, they put things out there. They'll put experiments that they want to see how the not only microgravity, but the vacuum of space and the little micrometeorites, you know, maybe what kind of impact they have on something, material science. Well, they'll take that, put it through the airlock, the arm will grab it and put it out on a porch and leave it there for 6 months, couple of years, whatever it is, and eventually bring them back in, you know, test out maybe, some kind of, anything, I guess, whatever they, you know, there's hundreds of experiments always going on. For instance, the next flight, not this flight, the next flight after that, they had an interview with one of the astronauts that are going to be on that flight, Dr. Kathleen, I'll think of it. Well, they had to put out 250 experiments she's going to be doing. So, mostly biologically experiments, but there's a lot of material tests that are going to go up. The Japanese guy, he's going up with them. Well, he's a material expert, and my guess, he's going to be in that Kaibo unit doing a lot of these types of tests with the robotic arm and the patio outside. And that's a way to do it. Put it outside and, you know, bring it back in without doing a spacewalk.
Now, if you're taking a CubeSat and you mount it on the patio, that's one approach. But some of of these cubes, and I thought they float freely in space. And so to put one on the patio, I don't see that as an easy way to launch it into space unless you're mounting it on a spring assembly on that patio. So to your knowledge, are any of the CubeSats, by way of this airlock, ever launched to be freely floating in space, or are they only brought by that arm out to the patio and then somehow mounted to the patio, maybe with a Velcro or something like that? Over to you, Paul. WS2N, Space Report, K2RIW, MagNet.
Oh, no, yeah, we're talking about two different things. The things that are put on their so-called patio is materials that they'll put there, experiments, they'll attach it to the patio. That's nothing to do with the CubeSats. CubeSats are different. That's actually, you know, pushed out of the airlock. One I saw had the robotic arm attached to it, and there was, like, I think three of them, and then they would release it, and on their own, they would separate from one another. Gears, how the spheres were going to react with one another, trying to control them with different systems. Whatever experiments they're doing, I'm not really up on it, but they have that choice. But no, the CubeSats don't go on the patio. You were asking what else does this robotic arm do? And that's pretty much it. And I thought of the astronaut's name, Dr. Rubin, Dr. Kathleen there. Rubin comes out of Connecticut. They're listening, I'm sure. Don't want to get that wrong. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Lou N2RQ is still with us. Lou, one further piece of information I should give you is that those beautiful recordings that are done by Mike Perry, KC2NJI, as a volunteer in New Jersey, where all of the tech nets for the last 10 years are recorded at that site, amateurradio.tangovictor. The recordings there sometimes appear in a couple of days. In other words, this is Sunday, and maybe it'll appear on Tuesday or Wednesday. Sometimes they take a week or so, week and a half, before they appear. So this particular recording might not appear there immediately. You may have to do some waiting, so you have to give them some fair warning. And it's too bad that the total discussion we had with you, Lou, is separated by various chunks of time. I guess it's possible for you to make a tape recording and take out the dead spots, if you know what I mean. Fast forward, so to speak, to the spots that are directly affecting cosmic microwave background radiation. And I may not have made it super clear, but as I was saying, that signal from cosmic microwave, let me drop it, is so darn weak to a terrestrial observer compared to a zillion other noise sources that are thousands and ten thousands times stronger in total noise power. That even though people have said in the past that an old amplitude modulated television set, when you're tuned to a non-station and you're looking at the white noise on the screen, the cosmic background noise is there. Well, yeah, it's 1/10,000th of the noise that's there. And that tape recording of Yankee Stadium, your father's voice is there, but you're not going to be able to pick it out. So it's a very difficult measurement, as you can tell. I guess in one way or another, I've made that somewhat clear. Fascinating experiment, and a person could, with modern-day equipment, duplicate that horn that was used in Homedale, New Jersey, to make a miniature version of it for, say, X-band or KU-band. Wouldn't be too difficult. You don't have to have all the fancy steering mechanism. Let me drop. And nowadays, you and I can easily buy YesFET transistors that can give you near cryogenic performance at room temperature. You and I can buy a transistor that operates at 10 gigahertz today that at room temperature will give you numbers like 40 degrees Kelvin of equivalent noise temperature. We're talking about a couple of tenths of a dB of noise figure. And for a few dollars, you and I can buy transistors that will do that kind of performance today and you can buy the transistor for under $10. So we've come a long way with modern day test equipment, spectrum analyzers, vector network analyzers, and so on to do this kind of testing. So it could be done, but to separate which source of noise you're seeing, terrestrial versus extraterrestrial, represents a fairly serious problem. And if you had pure extraterrestrial noise and pure local black body noise, although one would be a hell of a lot stronger than the other, they would both have the exact same amplitude distribution, time domain distribution. If you played each one of them at equal volume, don't think you'd be able to tell one from the other. In 2RQ, if you're still there, Lou, Mr. Malchuk, KQRAW in the TechNet.
Okay, I usually don't hang around this long when I'm at the net, but this was most worthwhile, and I appreciate it, especially the addendum you put on now. And according to the website, the last recording they have up is from February 28th, so it may take a little while, but I did take notes, and I've got a lot of information that I did not have before, so thanks very much. Work you.
And who are you? Lou, give me a couple more words. This project of the science department, the physics department of Brooklyn Tech, what started it off? How far downrange have they gone? And are they at the point right now where they need the random voltage generator, the random number generator is what I think they're trying to generate by this technique. What's the overall goal of that project? How long ago did they start? How far downrange are they? Are they funded? How much longer they're going to go? Give me a few words on that project. Sounds like a fascinating project. N2RQ, K2RAW.
Okay, I can give you very few words. I don't know. This is the students on the physics team, and I don't even know what that means completely. But they are talking about having a budget, and they're looking at some receiver type equipment, and we'll see. I hope to meet with them again at least on Thursday, but I will try to contact them by email. Sometimes that's not the most reliable. And if I find out more information, I'll certainly bring it back. Work you.
K2YO.
Pretty recognized. One last question, Lou. How did they choose you, Lou? You were the guy that taught them a lot of electronics in the past, and it seems to be an electronic requirement. Is that how they chose you, Lou?
I think what they discovered is that there's an amateur radio and wireless technology club, and they came specifically to the club meeting to ask that, and look what happened. There's a whole other story about why they just discovered us, but I'm not going to get into that here. This is Dan Gorky.
Okay, we got people lined up in the wings here. We've got Rich, Joe, and Bernie in that order who want to ask questions. Keep it a little bit brief if you can, Rich. N2EO, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. You know, something on the internet, and I keep in mind that a lot of the things on the internet are hogwash, but when you mentioned about elements, the experiment with lightning, and forming life every time. Life on another planet, that's what I want to talk about real quick. There was something on the internet about a planet in the Goldilocks zone, I don't know where, I don't remember, and they found what they believe is a man-made satellite orbiting it. It's a moon. But not a, it's a man-made moon. Do you know anything about that thing?
Dick, my comment, or my information was in regards to Lou's stuff.
That's what all the other questions are. Go ahead, Bernie.
know two things. Number one, if you need recordings right away, contact me directly. I can get them for you right away. Second thing, if you go to random.org, that website is a website that produces random numbers, and they at least started using atmospheric noise as their source, and they've got quite a bit of documentation of what they did over the years. So that may give you some good information also. K2YO.
Bernie, you've got recordings of what?
Lou was looking for recordings of tonight's TechNet.
Oh, I thought you were telling us you had recordings of cosmic background noise. You make a recording of the TechNet? How often do you do that, and what made you do it tonight? Go ahead, Bernie.
So, pass that information on to Lou.
Let's see if Lou needs a fill. N2RQ, K2RIW.
No, thanks, Bernie. I got it. boy, is this running late for me. Thanks again, N2RQ.
Rich, I don't know of the subject that you just asked. I have no information on that. And Joe, within a couple of minutes, we're going to be cut off. W2RYY, I think you had a question. K2RIW in the TechNet. There was another person besides Rich and Bernie who wanted to make a comment or a question. Who was that person? John, do you remember? It sounded like Joe. Did I hear him wrong? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Sounded like Joe to me also. I just heard a snippet of it, but yeah, it did sound like RYY. Maybe he had to go.
Yeah, we didn't get to him in the right order. And maybe he was getting tired. I can understand that. Okay, we've got 1 minute to go. You guys have listened to TechNet number 1593 of the series that began in September of 1982. Once again, we've discussed quite a bit of cabbages and kings, far and wide subjects. Anybody who's curious about science, astronomy, particularly radio hardware, that's what we discuss on the TechNet. Be kind to each other. This is a hobby that you're supposed to have fun with. Enjoy it. I'm going to pass it over to John and Paul in that order. KC2WGB. K2IW. Go ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. Well, I'd like to thank everybody tonight for joining the net, and especially for Lou. Great question, good topic. I'm sure we'll hear some more about that. I'd like to hear as that advances, interesting stuff. So, wish everybody well, and enjoy the hobby. That's what we're here for, and if everything goes well, we'll be back next week. So, I'll say 73. Paul and Dick and everyone on the net, enjoy. KC2WGB, Paul.
One last question for you, John. You were looking at the chat room and also the Echo Link. Roughly how many people signed in from the Echo Link? And I'm kind of curious, were any Canadians there, particularly from the so-called Golden Horseshoe area of Canada near Toronto? Over to you, John.
No, Dick, no DE calls on the Echo Link. We had about 10 on there. That was max, 10 or 11. On EchoLink, and we had 4 or 5 on the chat room. And by the way, Stanley Miller, that name was sent over by Dr. Roy, AC2GS. That's where I got that information.
And good old Stanley Miller, and also Harold Urey. 1952 did that beautiful experiment. We haven't heard the end of that one yet, of all the basic building blocks, the amino acids of life forming in an inert test tube. Let's just take this primordial soup, these raw ingredients, pass a spark through it, boil it, condense it, juggle it around like our atmosphere does, and do that for a couple of weeks, get this brownish goo that contains all of these amino acids. So a strong implication that life will crawl out of that flask if you wait long enough. And so, I wonder what would happen if we did that exact same experiment in the microgravity of the International Space Station. Wouldn't that be something, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
I'd like to see that. In the pale blue, I think it's the pale blue dot, I'll have to check by Carl Sagan. They have quite a few pages, 3 or 4 pages at least, of pictures. branches and everything dedicated to that topic. I'll have to look that up again. Refresh my memory, and I can bring that up on the net. So, they tried to duplicate. They used the chemicals that would be primordial earth at the time, what the earth's atmosphere is, or what it's like on Titan, going around Saturn. That moon is very similar to what the earth might have been like at that time. They took those chemicals, and that's what they used. I'll have to look further into it. Okay, very good, Dick. I'll say 73. John, Dick, I'll be looking for a flight. Nothing to do with a rocket, but a balloon as big as the Yankee Stadium that NASA's going to launch in down in New Zealand. It's going to set some kind of record. It'll go around the Earth once every week or so. High altitude balloon with a 2,000-pound experiment hanging from it. And they expect it to go about 100 days, which would break the record. It would double the time that anything has been floating around in a balloon. Back to you, Dick.
If I remember correctly, that balloon manages to hold itself at a constant altitude, a little over 100,000 feet. Balloons automatically expand because of lower air pressure as they get up higher, but they keep giving you the same amount of lift. But if you can stop the balloon from expanding, if the skin is strong enough, it'll go to a particular altitude and maintain that altitude. And I think that's what this is going to do. Isn't that roughly the procedure there, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. They tried that in 2014, and it only lasted, I think, about 20 hours. A problem at one of the joints where they have a lot of different joints where the balloon is attached. So they stiffen that up and use the gasket material in between. And I want to see how this thing works. That's going to be pretty exciting. Because, there's a private company called Paragon, or now it's a subsidiary, it's called Worldview. They plan on putting people at this 100,000-foot altitude in about a year or so. If this thing can't make it, I have no idea how Paragon's going to do it. We'll keep an eye out on all this stuff, ballooning, rocketry. All of it, aerodynamic planes and helicopters. Back to you, Dick. I'm going to be saying 73 until next week.
We've all said 73 multiple times. Bye-bye, you all. K2RIW clear.
KC2WGB clear.
I got a girl. I don't know, she was a secretary of water.
lot of major corporations that he's responsible for, so I'm sure he's got the bucks and, you know, he can do what he wants. Would it be good if he went public? I don't know. That depends on what they're looking to do in the long run, you know.
I guess, John, but, you know, if they had an offering, I'd probably buy, depending how much, you know, per share, I'd buy whatever I could, because it sounds like a good company, got a good basis, they got contracts with the U.S. government. Most of the public has no knowledge of SpaceX, what it is, what they do, but you know what? I think it would maybe be a very good investment.
Well, you may be right on that, but you have to realize, too, that Musk may want to keep it under their control. They have a board, and that's what they do. As soon as you go public, you're responsible for a lot of things that you have to do, and maybe he doesn't want to be bothered. He don't give a damn.
Maybe so, John. I don't know. But I think it would be a great way for me to make some money. Anyway, by the way, what I was saying to Dick, do you know anything about what I saw on the internet? I know most of it's garbage, but there was something, some astronomers found a planet, I don't know where, do you know about that? Where they found a moon going around it, they're not sure, but they think it might be man-made.
Yeah, an artificial moon. No, I haven't read anything about that. And you're right. Most of the stuff on the internet is garbage. You know, you really got to filter it and check it out before you can believe any of that stuff. You know, these guys out there, that's all they do is they watch the computer all day long and read this crap, and they just get inflated nonsense, really. But I'm sure if there's some worth to that, that we'll see a program on TV or there'll be more information on the web. Interesting topic. Would be nice to know, because if there's an artificial moon up there, we've got to find out who put it there. There was another one that thinks that they formed a Dyson sphere around a particular planet, and that's another thing they're investigating. That one I've heard of, but the artificial satellite, no.
John, what is a Dyson sphere?
It's a structure of connected elements that encircle the planet, and it allows them to have all types of controls. From the little I've read about it, which didn't really interest me, it's something that surrounds the planet, and they use it for a purpose, whatever that is. It's up to them, I guess.
Okay, now where did you read this? In our galaxy? How credible is what you read?
Oh, yeah, it would have to be in our galaxy. Where did I read that? One of the science nets, I read that. And, it's all what they think. There's no facts to back it up or anything like that. But, you know, they're checking into it and trying to get better observation notes and information. And they said, you know, it'll be a few years, maybe another 5 years, 6 years. Maybe another satellite will go up and see something that they don't know. But not much information on it, but just interesting topic.
Right, John. You know, this is all very interesting because I feel like Dick. I've been humbled before. I'm sure we're going to find many civilizations out there. We may not find them. Certainly not right away, but they have to be there. Earth is not the only planet with a civilization, I'm sure.
Well, it's not the only planet, and it's not the only planet with life. Will the planet we find have life similar to ours? Well, you know, if it's basically equal in a lot of aspects to our planet, yeah, we may find something that developed similar to us, but it could also be quite different. Who knows? There may be different silica life. There's so many different things that could be going on out there. And, you know, to think that we're the only one